Hello, everyone. This is Cassie Burns, co-founder of All Your Data. I'm an attorney who's been using AI and machine learning for 10 years. I love data and love talking to people about data, and that's what this podcast is about. Each episode of Cassie and will feature a new guest. Each guest comes from a different background with a different approach and attitude towards technology. We'll talk about their experiences and hopefully we'll learn a thing or two. Thanks for joining. Let's get started with Cassie and Isha. Isha, thank you so much. Isha Marate, thank you so much for joining this episode of Cassie and. I'm a big fan of yours, got to know you on LinkedIn as so many of my guests, but I would love for you to give your quick bio to the audience so they can learn a little bit about you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Cassie. This is exciting. My name's Isha, as you know. I'm a reporter for the American Lawyer Media on the tech desk, so for legal tech news. And this is my first actually full-time reporting job after college. And before that, I used to report on women's incarceration, actually. So as a freelancer.
Oh, really?
So yeah, kind of a job, I would say. Yeah, into legal tech.
But, you know, a focus on the law from the very beginning.
That's right. That's right. And that's what made me think of wanting to be somewhat of a legal journalist in some ways. So, yeah, see, that's kind of my intro spiel. And I'm really have been learning legal tech as I've been reporting on it. So I wish there was like a fancier answer to that, but that's really the truth.
I would love to ask you and dig into that because I feel like legal tech is a bit of a black hole for people kind of new to it. I've eventually evolved into my career in legal tech VE discovery. And it's something that I wasn't dropped into the deep end of the pool right away. You know, you just slowly get exposed to it. But as a reporter, not only are you getting up to speed on legal issues or reporting on legal issues, but also technical issues that are fairly, I think, hard to describe in quick soundbite. So what's been some of the most challenging aspects of covering legal tech for your beat?
Yeah, legal tech it's so interesting because you can look at it as a completely esoteric, a weird field of reporting. And then at the same time, the more you learn about it, you're like, actually, this is super pertinent. It's the intersection of law and tech, which is how we view it. And, you know, there's the arm that's products and tools, which is where I think the big challenge is. And then there's more stories about data privacy and how data tracking looks post Dobbs. You know, those are some of the stories that we do as well, or just looking at deepfakes and how courts are going to understand those. So I think it's, in a way, actually, the more I do it, the more I'm like, this is a really wide beat. And it comes with many challenges. And I think the biggest challenge, and I don't speak for my whole desk, really speaking for myself, is I think seeing through the smoke and mirrors of legal tech. I think that is really hard. And it used to be harder when I was new because there's so much marketing jargon out there. There's so much jargon. And as a reporter, you really don't want jargon. You know, it's like, it's kryptonite. You don't want it. And in many ways, your sources in legal tech are the vendors who can really help you understand the tech itself when you're reporting on the tech. So you get the press release, you get the demo, and you kind of get their spiel on what their tech is. But parsing through it, and we are all, especially AI, we're all kind of learning as we go. So being able to parse through it quickly, having those a little just collection of reliable sources who are going to help you understand and not just, it's not a marketing thing. That is, for me, the biggest struggle because I fear nothing more than publishing something and then someone going down the wrong path because of it, you know.
How long have you been on the legal tech desk, reporting desk? Has it been a couple of years?
2 years now, yeah. A little over
2 years. The reason why I ask is because you really came into this area of reporting at such a transformative time. And I think legal tech on its own is challenging because it is jargon filled. It is if you talk to anyone brand new to it, just like talking about families and children and metadata and blah, 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 it can be a little overwhelming. But then you add on this transformative moment of AI and generative AI, it's a lot of information to absorb. I'm sure like you guys need some sort of boot camp or something like that. It's a very steep learning curve. And then you add on other things like Web3 and blockchain and crypto on top of that. Yeah. What are some of the legal tech concepts that you found most challenging?
I will say I did not know what EDRM meant for months. I just pretended. I was like, what do people mean when they say both sides of EDRM? And like, I would look at, and I know you're the perfect person to answer that question. And I used to look it up. And each time I looked it up, I'm like, I'd ask people and they'd be like, oh, it's just this. And I'm like, okay, I guess it's just that. And I used to like remember it for the article and then forget because I'm not a lawyer. Like even the concept of discovery was just like, I knew it in theory. I knew it from some of my older legal reporting, but not in the depth of like, of what it really is, you know. So discovery was a tough part. And then I remember one of the first stories I ever did for ALM was about a wedding or marriage contract and a marriage that took place in the metaverse. And I just remember doing that story and I was like, I have no idea. What is this? You know, what does it mean? And like, is this real? Like, what is it? What is a contract in the blockchain? What is the blockchain? So I think some of those concepts were really hard. And generative AI is hard for sure, but it helps that I wasn't brand new. And it kind of, late 2022, I'd already been at ALM for almost a year. So it made it easier to kind of learn, you know, we were all learning together. But these e-discovery, you know, everybody just uses the terms that they're used to because it's such an established sector, obviously. And my editor sent me so many guides. And to this day, I'm just like, wow, a custodian? Like what? And now I get it, of course. But at the time, it was really hard. And you guys use a lot of terminology, a lot of terms, a lot of abbreviations.
You're absolutely right. We do use a lot of jargon and we stay in our little bubble a lot. And I think that we just don't realize how much of a little world of jargon that we do work in and live in. But are you finding yourself getting a wider audience? Because legal tech, I feel like, is fairly niche. And when it was really maybe more focused on e-discovery or like you said, cybersecurity or legal ops, you probably had a much more narrow audience. But then if you look ahead now, generative AI, probably everyone is kind of curious what's being said. Is that what you're finding your audience is kind of expanding with that broader topic?
Absolutely. Generative AI, kind of a night and day in terms of our audience, in terms of our readership. I think the big turning point was when Alex Jones's Dropbox incident happened, which was pre-generative AI, but it was at the time that I remember everyone was excited as e-discovery principles and like the clapback provision was quoted about in the New York Times. And that was the first time that I wrote an article that was kind of circulated beyond the legal tech bubble. But since then, it's generative AI, and we've been so lucky to be in an industry to have access to technologists and attorneys and really smart people who are good at not falling for the buzz, who are good at seeing through kind of the smokescreen that a lot of times tech has. So I think that has helped establish a lot of our writing and our research as reputable, you know.
I think bringing up the Alex Jones piece is interesting because I feel like right before generative AI, e-discovery was also having a wider moment because there were a lot of really high profile lawsuits happening in court where cell phone messages were major points. So you had Alex Jones, you had the Theranos lawsuit, you had the Amber Heard. Is that right? Johnny Depp. Just so many. It seemed like it was all at the same time. They were all hitting. I felt like e-discovery was kind of hitting mainstream, and then it all came to generative AI.
Yeah, generative AI did kind of overshadow everything. I remember there was a time when CLM was all we were reporting on for like a couple months. And I shouldn't say all we were, but it was kind of the hot tech that we were reporting on. I want to say clock 2022. And then, yeah, then it was generative AI that kind of took the spotlight. Yeah.
What's been your favorite thing to report on in the context of legal tech?
I will say the latest New York Times versus OpenAI copyright lawsuit has probably been one of the most interesting stories I've done. There's been the copyright litigation as a result of generative AI is truly just fascinating. You know, I reporting on it, I really felt like what we are talking about right now is going to have an impact on every single industry, entertainment, any type of content creation, certainly journalism, and a lot of writing. And I think that that was really a fascinating case. We'd been hearing from law firms and from tech vendors, but especially law firms who are adopting generative AI, that that was one of the concerns that they saw in the pipeline. And we'd been hearing this since early 2023, before copyright litigation was like having its moment. It was just a couple cases about artists. I would say one of my favorite things that I've reported on as of late is probably the New York Times versus OpenAI story, because, you know, it was kind of the most cohesive example of what a copyright case against generative AI providers looks like. And this isn't me taking a side or saying either which party's right or wrong, but it was the first time that it really felt like things we were reporting on truly at the intersection of law and tech were going to be touching on every single industry beyond just legal and beyond just legal tech. The other one, I think I'm always interested in geolocation, especially post-Dobbs. It's really fascinating. We've kind of followed some cases, some geofencing laws, some geofencing warrants, but there's a pretty big class action lawsuit in California that's set for trial in May. And it's the first ever geolocation privacy lawsuit to reach jury trial. So I am very excited and very interested to cover that and see how it pans out as well.
There is a documentary series on Netflix, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's about web and legal related issues. And one of the episodes talks about stingray technology. Have you ever heard of a stingray before? It's a device that can be used to kind of act like a cell phone tower. And if your device pings on it, it can then start collecting some of your data. And it's not widely known about, but I'll get the name of the series and send it to you. All of the geolocation data, and I have a very mixed feeling personally. On one hand, there are a lot of reasons to be concerned. But then as someone, I think a lot of women feel this way, there's always the potential we could get murdered at any point. And I feel like geolocation data makes it easier to find the killers of so many crimes.
Absolutely. And I think there's definitely so much benefit to the technology. I think the concern is when it kind of falls in the hands of people that maybe shouldn't fall in the hands of, or it's monetized to a degree that the consumer is then so separated from their data that they don't even know where it's going.
I was reading an article today about a data broker that is going bankrupt, and some of the data that they had collected was abortion clinic data. Yep. And the question was, can this data be sold as part of the liquidation process of bankruptcy? And I know that there's a senator that's trying to shut that down. I think that's something that generative AI has done maybe a little bit more, even though some of these issues regarding data aren't specifically related to generative AI. I do believe there's more scrutiny about everyone's data and what people are doing with data. And I think because of cases like the New York Times and OpenAI and other cases out there. I just feel like there's a little bit more attention and concern. Are you kind of picking up on that vibe as well, Isha?
Yeah, I think especially outside of the legal bubble where maybe people weren't talking, or I should say the legal tech bubble, where people weren't talking about data as much and things kind of still seemed a bit obscure or, oh, that's stuff that we don't really get. Generative AI kind of brought that into the room. And even for many attorneys probably who were like hoping to just, they're like, oh, we don't have to worry about that. And I think now it's unavoidable. I'm sorry, but it's just unavoidable.
Well, and I feel like you are seeing it from an interesting perspective, because I think journalism is without a doubt an area that's potentially going to be impacted by generative AI. We're already seeing reports of people who've written articles for The Guardian being reached out about articles they never wrote. It mentions them. The title of the article is comparable to things that they've written about before, but it was just made up content. So you have that aspect of it, and then have the aspect of, are some media companies going to potentially cut staffs thinking that they can use things like generative AI to create efficiencies? You may not want to share all of your personal opinions, but I'd love to hear like how you're seeing that affect your profession.
I think journalism is at a very precarious crossroads right now as an industry. We've seen so many layoffs. It's not really a sustainable business model anymore, the way that we've known it to be, sadly. And when you put generative AI into the mix, I think of two different kind of avenues. One is what you're saying, the use of generative AI in journalism. And was it, can some companies or some publishers maybe automate a lot of the stuff and maybe automate it to a degree where they're publishing content that is created by generative AI? I don't know how that would work because you can't copyright any of that. So I hope they know that. I don't know. Subscribe to LTN and find out.
Right.
And
then,
and I suppose the other side of it on journalism is journalism has been struggling with the misinformation, the wave of misinformation for so long, and certainly before generative AI. And I think that to me is the most immediate threat, especially election year. We have, not just in the US, but in South Asia, there's what I believe a billion or 2 billion people voting this year. And I think when you throw generative AI in the mix, and it is not at this point, it does not have the guardrails that it needs to have. I truly believe it does not. And for journalists, it's difficult. Like, I find it difficult. And I can't even imagine if I was reporting on politics in a country like India right now with mm-hmm. a massive population and so much misinformation. And I'm not singling out India. There's misinformation everywhere, but I say India because my family lives there and I'm familiar with what is happening to a certain degree. And I find that to be very scary. So yeah, there's the impact on reporting itself. And then there's the impact on the industry of journalism, which I'm sad for. And I'm sad what is happening in general to the model. But yeah, I think those are the two different ways that I look at it.
I love that you pointed out that you are correct. As of right now, anything created by generative AI is not protected by copyright. So, right. You know, I think people get lost in the headiness of, oh, I can save so much time using generative AI. But you may not want to do that with something you may want to monetize later, because you may not be able to claim ownership of that content. And, you know, I think that the disinformation is a huge problem. And I know that there are a few groups out there that are really trying to address it in some way by watermarking or, in essence, metadata. But that doesn't really stop the bad actors from still creating the misinformation. It's really just creating a burden, I think, on the people who want to be validated. For me, it nearly makes me think we come to a day where certain publications will have blockchain verified content. So people know, like, these are verified avenues of content, and maybe people will pay a premium for that, knowing that, because I think what we're going to start seeing is a lot of really junky, not valuable, nothing burger-esque content that just starts flooding the internet. So is that something you're hearing talked about in your circle of colleagues on the journalism side?
I have not heard much about how journalism organizations could better verify, could better mark their own content in order to separate it from the slew of, frankly, information that is just flooding everyone. And we see it, and we were talking about how our emails in post-generative AI, like, we get so much more PR that is just, it doesn't make any sense. It's not really applicable to our beats. But what happens is then we lose out on some good PR from folks that are actually putting effort into their PR pitches. So I think that we will see a similar trend in journalism. But journalism, I do want to say generative AI is also really helpful for journalists, because I think in terms of using ChatGPT for things like just sorting through a lot of data, just making an Excel sheet really fast, things that especially small newsrooms with investigative reporters, and I've done that, freelanced investigative, and it used to take us months to go through affidavits and to go through just all these redacted Excel sheets from the Department of Corrections at the time in Massachusetts. And it took a long time. And I think now if I had some of this technology, I would have plugged in that data into generative AI, or into a generative AI tool rather, and had it just sort through some of it for me. And at ALM, we already use images generated by DALL-E for some of our cover art, because it makes it quicker and easier and more engaging. So I don't want to write off the technology. It's certainly incredible. And certainly, I hope that journalists learn it rather than fearing what it could do to their jobs, because it's here. It's here.
You bring up a very interesting point. And I think that a lot of there's a lot of doomsaying of generative AI, but honestly, there's a lot that we do in our everyday jobs. It's very rote and time consuming that is very well suited for generative AI. And I think what will end up happening is it will free our time up to spend more time on more creative, maybe more like thoughtful areas of our work products. So we're not having to do kind of the grindy stuff. We're able to maybe spend an extra hour writing that or editing than we would otherwise get to have, for example.
Absolutely. I hope that that's what it does. And I think, and talking about journalism, I think about so many reporters who are laid off right now, and it's really hard for them. And I think about it all the time, to be fortunate to have a job where I'm able to publish every day. But I really think it can empower small newsrooms and reporters who may be laid off and who don't have right now the cash to hire a research department and hire a data analysis department, to just speed up some of the things that they would have otherwise taken months, if not years, to do. I'll say that much.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And Tyler Perry recently announced that he was down. He was not going to move forward with expansion plans of his studio system in Atlanta. And, you know, on one hand, I can understand he's wanting to use AI to have a leaner, meaner production house. But I really think what it could do, and my hope, and maybe I'm being overly optimistic, is it while some people may lose jobs at larger studios, they could also potentially go independent, because the barrier to entry, the cost to entry is lower potentially in creative areas, because there are all these AI tools that can maybe help them run their business. And it could lead to more creative, like new IP that we don't have.
I do agree with you about the whole Sora thing. And a lot of my friends are filmmakers, actually, and you know, they've been messaging me and they've been like, what do you think is going to happen? Are we all going to lose our jobs? And I think everyone fears that, just like lawyers do. So we understand. Not that I don't think lawyers fear it as much as maybe film folks are fearing it, or journalists. But what we hear all the time is that fear of lawyers saying, is it going to take my job? And I think I really hope what you're saying is what will happen is it'll just free up all of this time that we spend doing so much so that we can actually produce stories in journalism's case or do work that feels meaningful. So, yeah.
Well, let's try to be optimistic, Isha, because there's a lot of negativity out there.
There is.
And there's a lot of overhyping at the same time. And you have to be a little pragmatic. But I would love to hear, we're kind of winding down here, Isha. I would love to hear what you are looking forward to seeing happen or what you're most excited about in the coming year in the world of maybe legal tech or journalism or generative AI or emerging technology.
This is not like the sexiest answer, but I'm really excited to look at the copyright litigation. Like, I can't wait to see what happens. New York Times versus OpenAI, but also the cases, the art cases against Midjourney. And specifically, I'll point out, you know, this idea that prompting and meaningful prompting could potentially be copyrightable. And I'm very curious about how the U.S. Copyright Office and the Patent and Trademark Office are going to distinguish between what is a meaningful prompt and what isn't. And I think that that's kind of a path into so much of what we're talking about. But I'm curious, what do you think about that?
I think that someone can spend more time writing a meaningful prompt in Midjourney than I take taking a photo with my smartphone. And because let's be honest, I think creating really good quality images or artwork with those tools is much harder than people realize. All you have to do is play with it yourself and you realize this is different. And in a way, it like challenges our minds in different ways with art, right? My husband's an artist. And talking about you have to have a very strong grasp of language to be able to get the images that you want. And to me, like that in and of itself is there's an art form to that. And then you look at that coupled with if you're going to start putting a lot of time and effort into your analysis of what was the amount of human effort versus machine effort, that's that kind of a gray like spectrum that's kind of being hinted at. Like right now, U.S. Copyright Office seems to be taking a very hard line. But if they start taking like a graduated degree and, well, it depends on the time and effort, and that becomes a very fact-intensive analysis. And to me, that creates a high burden to establish ownership for rights that are you don't necessarily get a lot of the protections of copyright. Can't, you know, sometimes your best protection is just prohibitive. Like they can't do that anymore. You're not necessarily going to get damages. So you're going to have to put a lot of time and money into validating that the copyright is valid. It just seems like the system is a little broken. I mean, that's my personal opinion. I'm a big believer in that. I do think it is a tool. I think that you do spend a lot of time working with these tools, but I agree with you. I'm very interested in seeing how that shakes out because I don't think it's tenable in the long run. And we're talking about these in very black and white. It's human created, it's generative AI created, but it's going to get further and further integrated in tools we're already using. So really, like, how are you going to start carving that distribution up of it can be copyrighted, it can't? It just would create a huge burden on artists to keep track of their creative process. I spent 10% of my time prompt engineering and blah, 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 my time doing this. And no artist is going to want to do that. So I don't know. That's, again, my personal opinion.
Yeah. Is your husband worried about the technology at all? Or is that something that he fears? Or is he kind of interested by it in terms of the art side of things?
He's much more of a hand, like he doesn't really like using like digital art himself. Mm-hmm. So I think for him, and you know, he paints because he wants to. It's not something he's doing to, he has to make X amount of money or anything like that. And I think we have a lot of like philosophical discussions between the two of us because I think he feels far enough removed for it. He doesn't feel like it's taking away from what he does. And I think we've talked about it before and we're kind of on the same page. Like how far removed is DALL-E or Midjourney doing that when Andy Warhol didn't necessarily even screen print his own paintings. You know, he may have had some of the guys at his laboratory doing the screen prints for him. Or there's other artists like Motherwell who claim to, you know, like automatic painting where he wasn't thinking. It was just like the angels were telling his hand what to do. So when you start really parsing through some of those decisions, you start thinking, well, where do you draw the line? I don't know. So
yeah, it's fascinating. And I don't know that anyone has answers, but it is fascinating to look at. And I'm really curious about that, about copyright litigation. I'm really curious about the impact of Dobbs on data privacy and how states are kind of responding to the loss of Roe v. Wade and how that's going to affect the value we base on location data, on medical data, on healthcare data. That's something I'm really looking at this year. And just election, like how elections are going to affect deepfakes and deepfake pornography, which is probably the most prevalent type of deepfakes.
The deepfake pornography really concerns me. And even though there are some states percolating up and giving rights and causes of action, the last thing any female wants to do is go and deal with a court, whether criminal or civil, and talk about how this person made a deepfaked pornography video be. It's just absolutely, like, kind of terrifying, low-key. But, yeah, it's a big concern.
I remember being in high school and everybody talking about, like, nudes being, like, the big concern of if you send someone a picture, what could happen. And now it's kind of like, you don't even have to send anything. You don't even have to. It's just a couple people who are not thinking about you and who are just thinking about whatever they want to do. And it's really scary.
Well, well, hopefully in the next year, we will get some clarity on copyright and patent, but copyright in particular. I think, you know, you're absolutely right. There's going to be some movement there this next year. As we close this out, Isha, any kind of closing thoughts you'd like to share with the audience?
I would say be really discerning about what you see. Be really discerning about not just the images and the videos and the audio, but also about what content you're consuming, what news reports you're consuming. Just in journalism, in school, we always had the saying, if your mom tells you she loves you, check it out. And I think like that might be that might be true now for a lot of things.
Well, Isha, I want to thank you so much for joining me today as a guest on this podcast. I know I've learned a thing or two, and I'm sure my audience has as well. And to my audience, thank you so much for joining, and looking forward to seeing you on the next episode of Cassie and...